this is a huge issue that few people are engaged in.
Polio. Yeah, we changed the name of polio. So change the name of
vaccines
polio.
Vaccines only work when all or most of people are immunized. And so that's why I do believe that we needed to do away with the religious exemption.
They've done a lot of research. They're now coming back. They're briefing us on what they found, and they're going to get feedback.
There's optimism for moving forward, optimism about what can happen and the potential for where Hampshire can go, and especially with regards to staff.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. On this episode, we learn about a three-day conference on plastic pollution. Some anti-vaxxers confront a New York State senator over a recent vote. Massachusetts has several options for new east-west rail transit. And Hampshire College gets another new president. Well, that conference on plastics pollution and the environment at Bennington College in southern Vermont has recently wrapped up. And WAMC's Southern Adirondack Bureau Chief Lucas Willard was there.
Plastics have become an environmental crisis, and world leaders are starting to sound the alarm. On World Environment Day on June 5, 2018, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres released a video message urging the public to take action against plastic pollution.
Reject single-use plastic. Refuse what you can't reuse.
Bringing together journalists, researchers, and advocacy organizations, the Convening on Plastics Pollution Conference was held at Bennington College. The event was organized by Beyond Plastics, formed at the Southern Vermont Liberal Arts College in January. Former EPA Region 2 Administrator Judith Ank, a regular contributor to WAMC's roundtable panel, is director of the nonprofit organization.
Well, I think this is a huge issue that few people are engaged in. And people think recycling is the solution, but it's not. I'm a big advocate for recycling, but plastics have only achieved a 9% recycling rate worldwide. So we can't recycle our way out of the problem.
A series of lectures detailed the impacts of the 8.8 million tons of plastics entering the oceans annually. Issues of environmental justice related to plastics manufacturing and pollution, impacts on climate change, and more. Among the presenters was Dr. Pete Myers, CEO and Chief Scientist of Environmental Health Sciences and co-author of the 1996 book Our Stolen Future, which raised the issue of endocrine disruptors and the effects on human health of chemicals found in plastic products. Dr. Myers opened his presentation with a photo of his newborn granddaughter, born premature after her mother suffered from a condition known as preeclampsia. Myers linked his granddaughter's premature birth to exposure to chemicals released into the atmosphere as toxic smoke from the campfire in Paradise, California in November 2018. Myers said though some consumers are realizing the dangers of certain chemicals used to make plastic products, such as BPA, companies don't often change course or use new materials.
When the company asks, where should we put our resources, if they don't have a future-minded CEO making a strong commitment to getting out of this and into that, it's going to be hard to happen.
Bennington is just over the Vermont-New York border from Hoosick Falls and Petersburg. All three communities have struggled with the presence of PFAS chemicals in water supplies and the environment. Myers said that human exposure to endocrine disruptors is ubiquitous. He also argued that as regulators test for the chemicals, their methods are deeply flawed. He said regulators should examine the effects seen at both low and high levels of exposure.
High doses do different things, and those different things can be just as bad. But the point is that if you're a regulator and you're trying to find what are the consequences of exposure to this chemical, you always start at high doses. You pay attention to the things that change at high doses, and then you don't look to see what happens at low doses.
Plastics production is expected to ramp up, and that goes hand in hand with the oil and gas industry, and by extension, climate change. Carol Muffett, president and CEO of the Center for International Environmental Law, said it takes a lot of energy to produce plastics from petrochemicals.
Oil and gas producers, who are also the major plastics producers, are massively expanding their infrastructure to make new plastics. And unfortunately, with this build-out of new plastics and with the emissions that occur across the plastics life cycle, what we're seeing is a massive and growing amount of climate emissions from plastics, from the wellhead to the pipeline to the refinery to the incinerator.
According to a report released by Muffett's organization in February, plastics alone could eat up more than 10% of the Earth's carbon budget, the amount of carbon emissions that humans can release into the atmosphere to prevent the Earth from warming 1.5 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial temperatures. According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, some climate impacts would be irreversible. Muffett says stopping plastics expansion is essential to saving the planet, and that means greatly reducing the extraction of fossil fuels.
Keep it in the ground.
As for right now, plastics remain cheap and very profitable, with production expected to increase fourfold by 2050. Encke says the plastics pollution crisis cannot be solved through consumer choices alone.
I advocate for local and state laws that drive down plastic pollution, but we're only going to get that if more more consumers and more reporters are aware of the many facets of this issue.
Encke and other environmentalists have characterized some federal environmental bills as half measures, including the Save Our Seas Act, signed in October. On Thursday, Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar and other House representatives plan to introduce the Zero Waste Act. The bill would establish a federal grant program that advocates say would help communities invest in recycling infrastructure and other methods to keep waste out of landfills. For WAMC News, I'm Southern Adirondack Bureau Chief Lucas Willard.
About a dozen so-called anti-vaxxers and their children protested outside a public forum held by New York State Senator James Skoufis this week. They were there in opposition to the Democrats' vote in favor of repealing a religious exemption from vaccinations, which became law in June. WAMC's Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Allison Dunn reports.
Will it take the return of polio before we start taking this more seriously?
Change the name of
vaccines only work when all or most of people are immunized. And so that's why I do believe that we needed to do away with the religious exemption. We still have the medical exemption in New York State.
It's impossible to get.
Kathleen Bugolino of Chester has three children, and her middle one, a son, has autoimmune issues. Bugolino says neither her pediatrician nor specialist will sign a medical exemption, especially after the religious repeal became law in June.
It was tough enough beforehand. It's even tougher now.
Bugolino and her kids carried posters, including a certificate for her middle son's perfect attendance record.
Healthy children, all children have a right to school. They have a right to an education, a public education. My children have been healthy. I have a child who got 100% attendance this past year, but yet he's being considered a health risk to the school. How is this possible? Because I won't vaccinate him?
Bugolino says she helped organize Tuesday's turnout in part via the New York Alliance for Vaccine Rights. The protesters stood with signs outside Betty's Country Kitchen in Washingtonville, Orange County, where the Democrat was holding the first of his Skoufis on Your Street forums in his 39th district. First, he stopped on the sidewalk to speak with the protesters and said they were welcome to attend his forum.
I'm sorry that, there are some individuals and a handful of communities, quite frankly, in New York State that continue to, believe this junk science that exists. But society demands that government step in and protect the public's health. And that's what we did when we eliminated the religious exemption. This was good public policy. I was proud to support it.
Bugolino responds to Skoufis's having stopped to speak with her and the other protesters.
I was surprised that he actually stood here as long as he did. I really did expect him to kind of push through. So I was glad that he stood and he listened. I do believe he has a lot to learn about our side of the issue.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the repeal legislation in mid-June, following a measles outbreak in parts of New York City and Rockland County that began in the fall of 2018. Skoufis's district represents a portion of Rockland and Ulster counties and most of Orange County, where there are more than 35 measles cases. Again, Bugolino.
I have to homeschool. I'm a public school teacher. I'm going to go to school all day long and teach in Rockland County to come home to homeschool my children at night and on the weekends.
Her rising 7th, 6th, and 3rd grade children were attending Monroe Woodbury schools. The mother's asked to meet with Skoufis another time on the issue, and Skoufis said he would. Susan Blakeney agrees with Skoufis's vote. The Blooming Grove resident, now retired, worked for a pharmaceutical company for 30 years, where her first program was working on the oral polio vaccine.
Vaccines are known for their herd immunity, and we need the majority of the population to be protected. And then everybody will be protected because it doesn't allow the virus to come in and infect people. So anti-vaccine protesters, they can do what they want, but they shouldn't be allowed in public, especially in public schools and public daycare or anything in public. They should stay to themselves.
Attorneys Robert F. Kennedy Jr. with Children's Health Defense and Goshen Orange County-based Michael Sussman filed a lawsuit July 10th in New York State Supreme Court challenging the constitutionality of the repeal of the religious exemption to vaccination on behalf of 55 families. The mothers who spoke with WAMC say they are not part of that suit, but were asked and intend to file affidavits in support. Reporting for WAMC News, I'm Hudson Valley Bureau Chief Allison Dunn in Washingtonville.
If you spend a lot of time on I-90 in Massachusetts, pay attention to this next story. The Massachusetts Department of Transportation is examining six options for east-west passenger rail. Already, some of the scenarios appear to be non-starters. That story from WAMC's Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief Paul Tuthill.
One proposal calls for constructing a new high-speed rail line roughly adjacent to the Mass Pike that would allow for up to 16 trains per day, with maximum speeds of 150 miles per hour and travel times of just over 2 hours from Pittsfield to Boston and roughly 80 minutes from Springfield to Boston. The other five options all propose changes to the infrastructure in an existing rail corridor now used almost exclusively by freight trains. Three of the scenarios include various upgrades to tracks and signals along the existing route that would allow for up to six passenger trains daily with maximum speeds of 90 miles per hour. Two alternatives would install new track and, in one option, straighten out curves to allow faster speeds and up to 10 trains daily. MassDOT unveiled the options at a meeting Tuesday of the East-West Passenger Rail Study Advisory Committee, which is made up of elected officials, regional planners, and passenger rail advocates. The report did not include cost estimates. Democratic State Senator Eric Lesser of Longmeadow, who made East-West Rail a priority when he took office 5 years ago, said the options are exciting.
The real takeaway here is this is a feasible project. This can happen if we marshal the political will, if we keep at it.
Each of the six options will now be analyzed for environmental impacts, potential ridership, and costs to come up with three final alternatives.
They've done a lot of research. They're now coming back. They're briefing us on what they found, and they're going to get feedback.
State Representative William Smitty Pignatelli, a Democrat from Lenox who's on the advisory committee for the rail study, said options that use shuttle buses, not trains, between the Berkshires and Springfield should not be considered further. Two other committee members, Republican State Representative Todd Smola of Palmer and Democratic State Representative Thomas Petrolotti of Ludlow, questioned plans that do not have trains stopping at Palmer. Lesser said each of the six options is a series of trade-offs that involve costs, travel times, and frequency of service.
This is really an appeal to the public to stay engaged, to stay motivated, because we now do have the beginnings of what service might look like. So there's obviously a lot more to go, but it's very exciting to get it this far.
Rick Sullivan, president and CEO of the Economic Development Council of Western Massachusetts, cautioned it's a big leap from feasibility study to reality.
Being a realist, the study will be fine, but, ultimately there needs to be significant dollars.
The only east-west passenger train in Massachusetts that operates west of Worcester currently is Amtrak's Lakeshore Limited, with one eastbound and one westbound train a day between Boston and Chicago. Proponents of more frequent east-west rail say it will benefit Western Massachusetts by connecting people to jobs in the booming Greater Boston area and provide people there with an opportunity for lower housing costs within a reasonable commute. Another goal of east-west passenger rail, say advocates, is to reduce the number of vehicles on the Mass Pike to help lower the transportation sector's impact on climate change. Reporting from Springfield, this is Paul Tuthill with WAMC's Pioneer Valley News Bureau on the campus of Western New England University.
And the Hampshire College community is reacting after the appointment of a new president to lead the struggling campus. WAMC's Berkshire Bureau Chief Josh Landes has more.
In April, Miriam Nelson resigned as president of the private liberal arts college in Amherst, Massachusetts. It followed months of heavy criticism from students, faculty, staff, and alumni over her plans for how to bring the financially faltering institution into the future. Now, the college has appointed a permanent replacement with Ed Wingenbach, filling a role that college founder Kenneth Rosenthal has tended to in the interim. After a bruising year, the same campus that protested its last president is opening its arms to a new one. Salman Hamid, the Charles Taylor Chair and Associate Professor of Integrated Science and Humanities, served on the Presidential Search Committee and interviewed Wingenbach.
He, as he said himself, wanted always to be a Hampshire student, and Hampshire had been his ideal. So this is somebody who's coming in some ways, really excited about what Hampshire has been doing, and he's coming in to lead the college that has served as an ideal for him.
I'm really excited. I'm feeling a lot of new hope about our future, and I think that we're in a really good spot right now, or at least I hope we are.
Student Amy Lowe will be entering her third year at Hampshire this fall.
He really understands us. That's the big feel, is that he understands the trauma we've been through and what our next steps are.
Ed is ready to embrace the student body, isn't scared of the activism on campus, and actually is encouraging students to interact with him and share their ideas, and views that as a helpful part of the process.
Fellow student Elaine Robinson is entering her final year. Earlier this year, students set a college record with a lengthy sit-in at Nelson's presidential office.
Ed has said that he welcomes a sit-in as free labor. So says that if students are going to be in his office, then they're welcome to, and let's put a plan together and, you know, work on things.
The sense of needing to rebuild after calamity makes Wingenbach's appointment a more complicated moment for the college's staff.
It's been a rough year, and we have borne a lot of the brunt of a lot of what's been happening, and it's exciting to have someone coming in who has a sense of respect not only for staff but for all other stakeholders. And it's really exciting to be able to be able to work as a community to help Hampshire thrive.
Sarah Steele is a laboratory technician at Hampshire. She was on the search committee and has served as a representative for the college's staff advocacy committee. Steele is also a Hampshire alum. Sharing her own feelings and those of some of her peers, Steele said Wingenbach's selection was heartening.
But it's also mixed with the fact that we have very low morale right now, and things are difficult for a lot of us. And so there's optimism for moving forward, optimism about what can happen and the potential for where Hampshire can go, and especially with regards to staff. A lot of us will wait and see. But there's definitely a sense of optimism, and I think there's excitement too.
Reporting from the WAMC News Berkshire Bureau at the Beacon Cinema, I'm Josh Landes.
All right, that'll do it for this episode of the WAMC News podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Remember, stay subscribed for the latest from the Northeast. Till next time, I'm Ian Pickus.